So it's more than sitting at, you know, the head of a large table and ordering an expensive bottle of wine and proposing a toast and then communicating to your CFO, who happens to sit left of you, and your COO, who happens to sit right of you. That's going to accomplish absolutely nothing. Just the opposite of what you want to try to accomplish. It's about just being a part of a team. Nothing more, nothing less.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. This is Ben Morton, and welcome to episode 63 of the podcast. And in this episode, we are joined by Joseph Opdewey. Joseph is an international C-suite executive with experience that spans the Atlantic, and he has an outlook to match. Drawing on over 20 years' experience in developing companies in North America, the UK, and mainland Europe, he's an author and thought leader on the critical relationship between the values we live by and the value that we create. Born to a family of educators in Belgium, it was only natural that Joseph would be raised to embrace a diversity of knowledge, experience, and challenge. Throughout a lifetime of service, he's lived by a philosophy that's based on principles of respect, trust, and opportunity for all. In this episode, we get really deep into the weeds of exploring value-based leadership and Joseph's belief that it is totally possible to create value for our shareholders whilst operating in a manner that is fair and equitable for other stakeholders. We also had an in-depth conversation around how we as leaders can create an environment where the best idea wins, as opposed to just the ideas from those who naturally have the loudest or the strongest voice. On top of all of that, Joseph also shared some fantastic and really, really practical tips on how to recruit people whose values really fit with the organization. Before we get into the episode, folks, let me just share an offer with you very, very quickly. So I'm giving away complimentary access to my online weekly planning protocol course. In order to access it, simply leave a review of the show on Apple Podcasts and then send a screenshot of that review to me at chat@ben-morton.com, and we'll get your access details sent across to you. That's it on the offer, but let us get straight back to this episode. So without any further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Joseph Opdewey. Joseph, a very warm welcome to the podcast. First of all, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Good. It's my pleasure to have you on the show. So, Joseph, the very first question I love to ask every guest that comes on the show is quite simply, although it might not be that simple a question, but what does leadership mean to you?
Leadership. What does leadership mean to me? So I think leadership is about trying to bring everybody in an organization along on a collective path to success for that organization. So it's really aiming, I think, or aimed at harnessing the collective wisdom and the ability of every coworker for the common good of the company. So it's really, I think, an endeavor, at least in my mind, to ensure that everybody flourishes in the organization and prospers along the way. So if the company does well, the people who have done well for the company should do well, sort of my perspective. I want to create an environment in which everybody feels that they're part of the success of the company and of the organization. And I think that if everybody flourishes, if everybody feels appreciated, if everybody knows that they're implicitly invited to share their individual perspectives, their individual ideas freely, right? That's very important to me, sort of in an open and open-minded fashion. Then I know that everybody can help lead the organization in the right direction. And they can do so based on the ideas they share, based on the fact that they know that they'll have a listening ear for the ideas they share, and based on also the supporting behaviors and values they display on this whole journey. So I don't think of leadership as a static, linear sort of top-down type of concept. Like I think a lot of people, perhaps less now, but definitely in the past, think of leadership. I don't think of leadership in terms of hierarchy. Hierarchy is really a word I try to avoid in the organizations that I've been involved in. I think instead it is sort of the creation of, again, that open-minded and therefore fluid environment where people freely share their perspectives and where at the end of the day, the best idea always should win. And the best idea should always, and it doesn't matter who the author of the idea is, the best idea should always provide guidance for the direction of the organization. That's why we have to have a listening ear for whomever speaks up and invite everybody to speak up. And I think in an organization that embraces open-mindedness in that specific context, we all work for each other. And we all work for a common shared purpose, a purpose that I think is both meaningful and virtuous, or in the perspective, the collective perspective of all of us, that's a good purpose, right? One that we can stand behind. And I'm going to say something that's perhaps somewhat controversial. I don't think there is a leader of an organization. I think we're all leaders of an organization in that sense. If you think about the fluidity and an environment that is stimulating and where people can share their opinions and know that they're going to be listened to.
I love that last piece you shared around there not being one leader in an organization. And it reminds me of a pitch I was doing not long after I started running my own business to deliver what I was describing as a leadership program in an organization. I was pitching to the COO and some of her team. And I could only have been, I think, 5 minutes into the pitch. And she put her hand up and said, "Ben, I need to stop you right there." I said, "I've counted 7 times you referred to this as a leadership program. I'm telling you, it's a management program. There's one leader in this organization, and that's my boss." And it really took me aback. I was quite new to doing what I was doing in consulting and pitching. And I often reflect on that. I thought, what would I do now if I had the same situation? I think I probably would have stopped the pitch and explored and got to a true definition of really kind of what they meant by that. Because I'm very much of the same opinion of you in that we're all leaders, right? We can all share ideas and inspire and motivate those around us and set a good example. It's really interesting that you said that.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to explore the definitional aspect of that conversation, right? Because I have a couple of beliefs. The first one is that people who are CEOs in an organization, right, are there, quite frankly, of course, you know, through a combination of probably determination and effort, but they're also there because they've been lucky. And I think sort of when you think about this really objectively, in a large organization, you have to assume that there are people who work in that organization who are as good at you as you are or better as you are as a CEO. The only difference between you and them is that they've never have been given the opportunity. And so this whole notion that a lot of people have that the only reason why they are in a certain position is because they've worked their butts off. I'm not even doubting that they have. But the notion that that's the only reason is a false notion. The notion that your starting point in life doesn't determine your end point in life is a false notion. And the other aspect to this same topic is you have to be very careful, I think, about not being inclusive, because we spend a tremendous amount of time and effort in identifying talented people, right? So you go to recruiters, you pay them a large recruitment fee, then you go through, 5 different interview sessions with 5 different people. You make sure that these people are aligned, hopefully, in terms of their values and their quote-unquote virtues, and that their virtues fit the values and all that type of stuff. And then you've recruited those people, and they finally are onboarded, only to find out, poor people, that they're not being listened to, and that their opinion doesn't matter. And so it begs the question, why spending so much money for the identification of the talent, A, and B, it'll lead to a disillusioned workforce. These people have been brought on board based on a number of promises, based on a brighter future. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made the choice for your organization, and only to find out that they're not being listened to and that they don't participate in the decision on the strategic direction of a company. And so what happens with those people is ultimately 2 years later, disillusioned again, they leave the organization. The company has spent a lot of money. And what's left is mediocrity, because the people who stay in the organization are the ones who are not troubled by the fact that they're not being asked what they think. I think that would have been an interesting conversation. Needless to say, I mean, if I understand the definition of management and only one leader correctly, then it's something that I vehemently disagree with.
Yeah, likewise. And Joseph, what you're saying just then reminds me of something I wanted to ask that you mentioned in answering the first question. You're speaking about ensuring that the best idea wins. Like, how in your experience do you actually make sure that that happens? Because I think it's quite common in business or in any organization, right, for it not always to be the best idea that wins. Sometimes it's the person who speaks the loudest or the person that is the maybe the best networked or whatever. So how have you ensured that that has happened in the organizations that you've led?
Yeah, well, surely I would probably overestimate my own capability or the capability of the team if I were to say that we've always been able at capturing the best idea. We haven't, right? But I do believe that the way to start this sort of cultural journey in an organization is by breaking down barriers, by breaking down hierarchy. And I know an organization probably, although I would love to try, couldn't function without some level of hierarchy. But okay, let me take a different example, a CFO moniker or a CEO moniker. Okay, it is a deterrent rather than an invitation for people to share their opinions with you. Right. So there's this whole sort of power distance theory, right? And so what you need to do in an organization, in my mind, is to try to create an environment whereby people are not afraid by the fact that they're talking to somebody who, quote unquote, in the hierarchy, has a different level than they do. And I hate those words, right? I hate the words level and all that type of stuff. I don't think it's conducive to good business. But unfortunately, it's there. And I think the way we've always done it is through a combination of a number of things. The first one is, I say we, by no means a royal me. It is my absolute conviction that not one single person runs a company. It's a team. Mm-hmm. It's a group of people. We're all leaders of an organization. That's why I'm using we, right? It's never the endeavor of one individual, right? So, it starts with very simple things. So I'm involved in a startup now that I started myself. And what do I do every morning? I go to every single individual in the organization. And, it's probably 100 people now. And I go and sit at their desk and I talk to them about their lives, their dog, an idea they may have, everything. And I'm trying to break down those barriers, that sort of power distance, if you want. And I'm trying to just make them understand that we're all at the same side of the rope here. We're all pulling in the same direction, and we're all trying to achieve exactly the same thing. And, we crack a joke and what have you. Well, that in itself, okay, has a tremendously positive impact. And it's more than just the obligatory handshake in the morning. It's not that. It's a true interest, I think, from us in everybody else and from everybody else in us. And so friendship, right? The friendship that emanates from that, the step beyond being just colleagues or coworkers, right, is a very important point, I think, in this journey of trying to ensure that everybody speaks up, because you can't capture the best idea if people don't speak up, right? The second thing that we've always done, and specifically in larger organizations, but even now in the startup, we do this once a month, we do like an extensive sort of town hall. And the town hall is where we as a team talk about, okay, this is the company today. This is where we've done well. This is where we should have done a little bit better, right? These are the goals, a medium term, long term. And this is how you as an individual can contribute to us achieving those medium term goals, long term goals. And by the way, what are your ideas? And so since we have this camaraderie, and since we spend time at work, but also outside of work, and everybody knows each other as friends and coworkers, it's not easy for a lot of people to speak up when they're surrounded by 100 other people, of course, right? But still, it's an environment in which I find, and more so since we've done more of them, where people do speak up freely, do ask relevant questions, do make very useful suggestions. And what we then do is we immediately set up a meeting in which all functional areas are involved and where we can dig deeper into those ideas. The last thing I will say is you have to make people, I think, feel at ease with the fact that it's okay to have an opinion about something that does not belong to their functional area. So if somebody who works in a marketing department has an idea in supply chain, right, then that person should be should feel totally free to share that opinion. It is not because somebody works in marketing or in finance or what have you that they can't have valuable ideas that pertain to other functional areas. So that cross-functional fertilization, I think, is also a very important aspect. And of course, I could talk about this forever and eternity, but I think those are very important things. The last thing I'll say is, you know, in addition to the town halls, we also do quarterly reviews, definitely in the larger organization I've been involved in which we would travel into the different regions and we would gather all of the plant managers and what have you. And we would allow everybody to share their forecast, reforecast if you want for the year. And then we'd take everybody out for dinner and we would have just a good time. Mm-hmm. Just a good time as friends amongst one another. And I know it sounds somewhat, you know, romanticized perhaps, but, you know, you have to create the vibrancy and the energy. And the vibrancy and energy will do two things. It will allow people to stay with the organization who otherwise may leave because they know they're not going to find such a vibrant organization elsewhere. It also allows for this interchange of information and it allows for progress. Success, vibrancy, and energy will reap success, vibrancy, and energy. And the organization I'm involved in now, that's really the most beautiful thing I've seen now, right? So it reminds me of my very first job, which was also a startup, which became a global organization. And still today, almost once a month, I have sort of a virtual reunion with all of the people who were with me. You know, this is 20 plus years ago. And still all of those people, without exception, will describe those years as the best years in their professional lives. Well, if you can achieve that, you can achieve what's greatness. Yeah. You can achieve a lot of things that other organizations who can't capture that collective energy would not be able to achieve.
Joseph, I think listening to you talk there, one of the main things I heard, which is really reinforced the belief or fact that it's just so important for leaders to be visible, right? I heard you talking about wandering around either physically or virtually, stopping by people's desks for a chat, the town halls, going to your sites overseas and taking people out for dinner. I think when leaders are visible and people see them, it's easy to share ideas, right? And to remove some of those natural hierarchical barriers that can potentially exist in an organization versus when a leader, MD, CEO barely comes out of their office or comes down from the top floor of the building and people don't see them very often. It is going to be hard for people to connect and feel kind of safe around them, right?
Of course. And I can't tell you how many organizations I stepped in. So I've been a CEO of 6 large organizations, global organizations. And in each of those, or many of those, when I arrived, the executive team had sort of their own quarters, right? And you needed to make an appointment to talk to somebody in the executive team. And very often you needed a special badge to have access to the special quarters of an executive team. Well, what a wonderful way to create an inclusive organization, right? Get rid of the badges, yeah. Get rid of the badges, get rid of the appointments, right? You know, creates an open door culture. The other thing I will say that I think is very important is this aspect of being approachable, being humble, listen, they have children, we have children. Certain things in their lives have gone well, certain things in our lives have gone well, certain things in their lives have gone horribly wrong, and certain things in our lives have gone horribly wrong, right? We have many more points of comparison, if you want, and many more touch points that we can talk about outside of work, right? And so if you are humble, and if you're sort of, you know, somewhat self-deprecating in the way you speak about yourself and all that type of stuff, that also, you know, tears down barriers, obviously, right? So it's more than sitting at, you know, the head of a large table and ordering an expensive bottle of wine and proposing a toast and then communicating to your CFO who happens to sit left of you and your COO who happens to sit right of you, that's going to accomplish absolutely nothing. Just the opposite of what you want to try to accomplish. It's about just being a part of a team. Nothing more, nothing less. It is about all noses in the same direction and your value individually or as an executive team collectively, it has no larger weight than the value of anybody else at that table. That's what this is about. Listen, we all share life, right? We may not share the same ideas. We may not share the same political convictions, but one thing we all share life. We all share the sorrow and the wonderful, incredible beauty of life. And so that's a lot to talk about, a lot to talk about. And that, I think, creates fondness and creates togetherness. And without togetherness and fondness, there isn't a vibrant, energetic, creative environment.
Yeah, so Joseph, it sounds very much like you've been describing humanity there, really, which is probably a nice lead-in to ask you about the book that you've just written, which, as I understand it, is a collection of short essays and your reflections from your career in business. So can you tell us a little bit about Fair Value and why you decided to write the book and why you wrote it now?
Yeah, So this may surprise most people. I actually didn't want to write a book. It wasn't my intention to write a book. So what happened was I now and then in my spare time, I sort of wrote some, you know, thoughts, essays about value-based leadership, really, right? That's what it's all about, value-based leadership. And at a certain point in time, I was approached by a publisher and I was asked the question, you know, can you tie these all together, right? Can you tie them together into some type of coherent set of essays around value-based leadership. And of course, I hadn't necessarily written them with that specific intent, right? And so I looked at it. I said, yeah, we could probably tie these together. And, you know, much to my surprise, somebody was then willing to publish the book. It wasn't I never had on my bucket list, okay, I want to be a published author. I don't think it's a management book, and it's not intended to be prescriptive. Hopefully, it doesn't have the arrogance of making anybody believe that I have all or even any of the answers. It's just reflections. What it is, it's trying to draw a parallel between events that surround us and value-based leadership and how there's cross-fertilization between those two, how certain aspects of what we're seeing or not seeing in society influence business and how we can draw lessons of what to do and what not to do in running our businesses. And conversely, certain things we do in our businesses, you know, certain politicians probably would be well advised of listening or looking at that, right? So that's sort of the way this all started. I'm not a politician. I have certain beliefs, but I would say they're more sort of humanistic beliefs than anything else. But that's the way this all really started. I wrote these little, scribblings, and then some media outlets picked up on them. And that's how probably somebody noticed that, hey, this is getting a tiny bit of traction. And so that's how this came about, really.
And when you say value-based leadership, what do you mean by that? What's value-based leadership for you?
It is to add the questions, how to best create shareholders' wealth. Listen, you come from business school and yes, you have a vague understanding of what cash flow means and what EBITDA means. And then I ended up in the financial services industry. And then I ended up in private equity owned businesses initially. And obviously, it was all about, you know, how to best create shareholders' wealth. But it was very often, not always, but very often without regard of other stakeholders. And there are at least four other stakeholders, right? So in addition, there are, of course, the shareholders, but in sequence of importance, the most important stakeholder are the associates or the co-workers in the business, right? And I would argue the second most important ones are the customers, right? And then we can have an argument as to whether or not shareholders follow or whether the broader environment in which we operate follows, right? But those are sort of the stakeholders. And so this wild, unnuanced, you know, pursuit of shareholders' wealth creation over time, but relatively early on, quite frankly, in my life, luckily, and also because I was surrounded by great people who whispered in my ear and I had great mentors, the question about how and how to best get there became very important questions. And so that is value-based leadership. It is to not only focus on, okay, by 5 years from now, we want to achieve this revenue number and this EBITDA number and this cash flow number, and this is what our balance sheet should look like, because this is the equity value goal that we have in mind. It is also about nurturing the best of people, making sure that you bring those people across for the journey, make sure that they're happy in the journey, making sure that they're rewarded in the journey. And when I speak about value-based leadership, there are values that we always speak about throughout that, you know, those six organizations. And it's quite remarkable, actually, when you look at it 20 years ago, what we wrote down as our core values and what I would write down now as our core values is very similar. And it is openness. So openness means share your ideas freely. Open-mindedness means listen to those ideas freely, right, without prejudice. It is creativity, right, which is very, very closely interlinked with those two, because if you don't practice openness and open-mindedness, you can't expect a creative environment. It is fairness. It is respect. And it is speed of execution. Speed of execution is not the same as making impulsive decisions, but it is making sure that once you've made a decision, you execute, you know, against the plan and against the budget by harnessing the collective energy of the team. And then there's another one that we constantly talk about. Of course, listen, I have not mentioned integrity because I'm assuming that that's a given, right? So I'm not going to, it's the same as saying, I'm assuming that people who work in an organization actually do work for the organization. Integrity is an integral part, obviously, of who you need to be in order to work in an organization. But respect is a very important one. We have never condoned in organizations people who raise their voice, people who treat other people without respect, people who lose their patience, use insulting remarks, diminish people. That was a very, very, from the very, very first moment onwards, and I'm talking about 25 years ago, a very important point. I mean, that allows for everything else to fall in place. In my mind, that's value-based leadership. And what we do when we recruit people is this may sound really silly, but anyhow, and it was easier before COVID than it is after COVID, or during COVID. But if we have somebody who we really like for a job, we put him in a taxi or her in a taxi, and we see how he or she interacts with the cab driver.
I love that.
We take him out for dinner, and we see how he or she interacts with the waiting staff or to a Starbucks, right? To use or like a prêt-à-manger, to see how they treat the person who serves them the coffee. And it doesn't matter how incredibly good they are at what we're planning to hire them for. If we see any type of dissonance in terms of how we want people to treat other people in the organization, because core values they're not limited to work. They also are things you apply in your personal life, right? So then that person is not the right person for us. So we do those things, and we do those things, of course, without announcing that we're doing those things, right? So, we've missed out on very, very capable people because of it, but it's still in my mind the right decision.
Yeah. So two things one thing I'd love to share and one thing I've got to ask based on what you've just said, the piece around core values I love. So often when I'm working with clients or running leadership programs, I'm getting people to explore their core values. I often get asked the question, Ben, are you talking about work or home? And my answer is normally, it's broadly the same, right? Our values are our values wherever we are. You might have one that's maybe slightly different and doesn't show up quite as much at work or at home. But for me, like, I have one set of values and I aspire to live up to them and be true to them in all aspects of my life. I don't suddenly like pick up another set when I go to work with my work bag. So I think values are our values. But the super tactical question, a detailed question I want to ask you. So the taxi driver that you get feedback from, were they like a plant from the business? Were they employed by you? Or did you just kind of set it up where you said to the taxi driver, look, after you drop this person off. I want to give you a call and find out what they were like. How did it actually work?
No, I'm sitting next to the candidate, or somebody sitting next to the candidate.
Okay.
And we're just looking, we're observing the interaction. And the other thing that we do is to stimulate the right behavior is we are our natural selves with the taxi driver. So we ask him, how's your day, or her, how's your day, and all that type of stuff. So it's not so that we don't create the opportunity for people to mimic behavior, right? We do, right? So it's not a setup or anything like that. It's a genuine life experience, right? But a very valuable one.
Fantastic. And Joseph, I've been looking at some of the reviews for the book on Amazon, of which there are plenty. And there's one that really jumped out at me that I've just got to get your take on. So I've got it written down here. Somebody wrote on Amazon, "Is this a business book or a spiritual primer?" So I've got to ask you, like, what do you think is going on there, and what do you think prompted that reader to write that particular review? Because I just found it really interesting.
Yes, and so of course I don't know the specific reader or what the motivations may have been, but I was thinking about it, and because there are more inferences to the fact that this is a book about philosophy more than it is a book about business. And by the way, I'll take that any day of the week. I think it may have to do with the fact that when you talk about value-based leadership, right, it is not quantitative, is it? It's qualitative, is it not? And so it doesn't follow sort of the straight lines of, have you made your EBITDA target? Have you made your revenue target? That's binary. The answer is yes or no. This is more of a journey. It is more of a collective journey of an organization and the people within that organization of enrichment, of, you know, sort of, I would say, moral and intellectual prosperity, quite frankly. And so I do think it is a lot easier to make an inference that this is a book about philosophy than this is a book about business. I also think that the constant back and forth between what goes on in society at large and then transposing that into what goes on in the business, and conversely, what goes on in the business and transposing that into what goes on in society at large, makes it more of a philosophical set of essays. It's only after, you know, when you write these things, right? So you sort of, because you write them in little tidbits and then you have to tie them all together. So that's when you reread the whole thing. But it's only sort of half a year later a couple of months later when you reread the whole thing that you really find certain angles in it that you probably didn't discover initially because you're too close to it, right? So you need a little bit of the advantage of distance, and then you look at it and you say, yeah, it is perhaps a little bit too, I don't think it's too philosophical in nature, but there are a lot of inferences that could be viewed as political, or it could be viewed as sort of philosophical in nature. And, you know, they're going to be off-putting to certain people, right? I mean, clearly they are, and that's okay, right? They clearly were, and quite frankly, on rereading it, still are a reflection of what I believe in. And I think that's why somebody may make that remark. I don't know. We would have to ask the individual, wouldn't we? But yeah.
Yeah, I think that particular remark was made in a positive context, by the way. Reading the rest of it is meant to be very complimentary.
Yeah, no, I, and by the way, I saw the book, got good reviews, but let's be honest, okay, the sample size here is not very large, right? So so we'll see. We'll see if more people read it and we get more reviews, whether the reviews still remain positive.
Accept the positive feedback, Joseph. Accept the positive feedback.
Okay, I shall.
So there's one word that cropped up a lot when I was sort of doing my general research to chat to you today, in terms of looking at some of what you've written yourself, looking at some of the reviews from the book, and that was the word honesty. And the one question I had around that really is, as a CEO of a large corporation, large PLC or whatever it might be, do you think it's ever possible for a senior leader, a CEO, to be totally honest with those in the organization? And if not, then how do you reconcile that and lead in such a way so as you don't sort of damage the trust of those that you lead? Because it's a question I get asked quite a lot in my work. Like, yeah, we know honesty is important, Ben, but there are times when I just can't be honest with my team. So what's your take on that, Joseph?
That's a good question, I think. And so let me ask you, right, because I think there may also, as so often in life, be a definitional issue here, right? So I don't think honesty necessarily is the same as 100% transparency, because you and I know if you run a large business, there are certain things you can be 100% transparent on. Let's say in a public company, you're about to engage in an M&A move. Well, that's not something you are even allowed to talk about from a regulatory perspective, right? So, but do I believe in honesty? Absolutely, I do. And with the caveat of this definitional difference between 100% transparency and honesty, honesty means that you have to share your beliefs, in my mind, without a sort of a Machiavellian consideration of the potential negative consequences that honesty may have, because honesty is not always popular. It's not. I don't want to sound like an old grandfather, but in 1998, right, and I was just at the beginning of my quote-unquote career in industry. I had left financial services, and you know, we had a flourishing business. It was a startup. It was a flourishing business. It did very well in the first year. I think in the first year we had $15 million dollars of revenue and probably $4 million of EBITDA, and we had grown from 0 to 1,000 people almost. And so the next year was going to be, you know, double the revenue, double the EBITDA, and all that type of stuff. Currency crisis hits in Asia, and most of our export destinations were Asia. All of a sudden, our products became twice as expensive overnight. Our demand plummeted, gone. Okay. I had to lay off 85% of the workforce. Now, I was very honest with those 85% of the people. But it certainly wasn't a popular message, right? You know, there's a beautiful ending to the story, which is we actually sort of reinvented the business and very quickly got a different contract, also automotive, but in assembly, and we were able to rehire most of those people. I mean, all's well that ends well in that particular case. But I think honesty is so closely related to the values of openness and open-mindedness and creativity, that how could you preach a sort of value-based leadership model if you're not honest with your people? I know I've been honest. I know I've been honest with my coworkers. I've been honest with boards. And there have been situations where it wasn't in my best interest, to be honest, and where there were ramifications of honesty. That doesn't mean I had the right or the wrong opinion, but I had a conviction. It does mean that I was able to hold my head up high, wasn't it? But that is something that I think is very important in business. You have to be able to look back, and you have to be able to look back at what's now, you know, over 20 years and respect yourself through this whole journey. You have to, not just yourself. You also have to gain the respect of all these people who have made this work with you. And quite frankly, to a certain extent for you, right? Let's be honest. You need to be able to cultivate those relationships and build long-term partnerships. And you can't do that if you're not authentic with yourself. And don't tell me that people who've worked with you for 5 years or 10 years don't know when you're not authentic. Of course they do. And by the way, what's even worse, you know you're not authentic with yourself when you're not authentic. So it all fits into this whole value-based model, does it not? So yeah, I do think you can be a great CEO. I think you can be very honest with your people. I think you can be very humble, self-deprecating. I think you should stand in front of all of them when you make a mistake. I think you should admit to the mistake. And that makes you only more approachable.
Mm, I think it's wonderful what you've just shared, really around authenticity, starting with yourself first, right? You've got to be authentic to yourself probably before you can be authentic to anybody else. Joseph, I'd like to finish with a few quickfire questions, if we may. The first one is, and you probably answered this already, actually, what do you think are three key characteristics or traits for leaders in the current global sort of business climate?
I don't think they're necessarily linked to the current business climate. I think they may be sort of universal. I believe in that, right? So we've spoken about this, certainly, the willingness to break down hierarchy, right? In breaking down hierarchy, you have this wonderful byproduct that comes over time, You're doing it because, first of all, you're not a pompous prick, quite frankly, but you're doing it also because you have a desire for everybody in the organization to flourish, not just an elite in the organization to flourish, everybody in the organization to flourish. And why? And why? Because you want to create this vibrancy. You want to create this energetic environment, this sort of fertile, if you want, work environment. That, I think, is not that anybody is waiting for my advice, but it is my number one belief. It is my number one belief. It is to break down the power distance. You know, if your door is closed and you've got a little sign on your door that says CEO, trust me that people will not come to you with the information that you need to know to run that business well. So how do you overcome that, right? I think another one, and this is a journey for the entire organization, is to try to get rid of sort of a subconscious bias, right? Is to understand that people have different opinions and different perspectives, is to embrace diversity. Diversity in every aspect of diversity, because different walks of life and different backgrounds in different industries and different backgrounds in terms of education, different cultural backgrounds, all levels of diversity will create a better company, in my mind, at least if combined with the willingness to listen to what these people have to bring to the organization, right? So you have to see, I think, and this becomes increasingly difficult, definitely, you know, in the last 10 years, but you just have to see beyond partisan views, and you have to just rise above. And then I think the last thing that I think the third aspect is in the right spot, but obviously you have to have some ability to determine what the long-term strategic perspective of the business should be, right? So this ability to think long-term, to think in a strategic fashion in the context of a strong value-based belief system is very important. I think if I may expand on that, I think a lot of people make the mistake of being the victim of the latest phone call they made. So they have a certain opinion, and then somebody, for whatever reason, whispers in their ear without a lot of facts or what have you. Well, you know, how about this, right? And so you can't constantly be the victim of the last phone call, last conversation you've had, because then that leads to total, like, people don't understand the direction of the organization anymore. Panic, lastly, in this whole long-term strategic thinking, is the worst counselor. So you always have to understand that even in the darkest of times, and businesses sometimes go through very tough times. I would argue no successful business is a successful business if it hasn't gone through tough times. In those days, in those times, you have to just be, take the right amount of distance, of course, understand the ramifications of those dark times to everybody in the organization, but keep a cool head. Those would be my three picks.
And it brings us beautifully back to nearly where we started, I think, in terms of making sure the best idea wins, as opposed to the latest idea that you heard winning, right? The last conversation that you had.
Yeah.
And Joseph, final question, if I may. What would you say is the one book that you've read that really has had the greatest impact upon you?
Oh, that's a difficult one, is it not? At the risk of this being somewhat controversial, because I think the book was somewhat controversial, at least in those days. But I do think I reference, if I'm not mistaken, The Grapes of Wrath in Fair Value. Let's go back to what that book really is about, right? It is in the midst of and against the backdrop of a Great Depression. It is about unimaginable suffering of migrant families who essentially move from one state in the United States. Well, they're all immigrants, obviously, but they move from one state in the United States to, I think, California. Everybody moved westward in those days to try to find a better life. I think this is a story about this dichotomy, right? About short-term versus long-term thinking, really, right? It is about, should crops be used to profit few, or should crops be used to feed many, right? And when you think about the book and when you think about the premise of the book, you see, I think, the main characters gradually evolve from a perspective of individualism and materialism to a more sort of collective perspective, an embrace of community, because they ultimately come to the conclusion, this is in the midst of tremendous hardship, they come to the conclusion that, as the French say, l'union fait la force, that community ultimately serves more people more equitably. And I know it was lambasted, you know, in the 40s and probably even blacklisted for being, you know, a socialist sort of manifest. That's not at all what it is. It is very much in line with what we're discussing here. It's a value-based novel, and it describes a journey, a bitter journey, of how people essentially are able to understand the greater collective good. That would probably be my answer. Now, there are probably many other answers I could give, but this is one, I think.
Brilliant. Joseph, thank you so much for your time today. I've absolutely loved chatting to you and spending time with you. And I'm fairly sure what you've shared will inspire many listeners to go and lead in perhaps a more fair and ethical way. So thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
You too. Thanks, Joseph. I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks. But most importantly, I really hope that you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. If you did get value from this episode, then please do rate, review, and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again in the next one very soon, and lead on.